Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome, and thanks very, very much for joining us today. I'm very excited about the interview that I'm going to share with you in a moment. This was a conversation that I just had with Eleanor Goodman, who's a poet and a translator who's just done a translation, a really beautiful translation of Wang Xiaoni's Something Crosses My Mind. This came out in 2014 by the Zephyr Press and the Chinese University Press of Hong Kong. Now, this is a collection of poetry that's absolutely gorgeous. And even if you are listening to this and you don't imagine yourself to be deeply interested in Chinese or Chinese literature, this is a book that you can appreciate as a work of literature in English as well. So over the course of our conversation, we talk about the translations of this really amazing contemporary poet. We talk about the significance in her work of where she's from, the poet that is. We talk about some of the major themes and major kinds of image and movement that come out of her work. And most excitingly, or at least one of the really exciting things for me to share with you, is that Eleanor was generous and kind enough to read some of these poems for us. So in the next hour, you'll not only hear about her craft and decisions as a translator, you'll not only hear about this really amazing contemporary Chinese poet, you'll also have a chance to experience some of this poetry as read by Eleanor. So I'm really thrilled to be able to share this with you. I'm really grateful as well to you for listening and for your support of the channel. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Thanks so much for listening. And here we go. Enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Eleanor Goodman about her new translation of Wang Xiaoni's poetry, Something Crosses My Mind. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Eleanor, and thanks very much both for giving us such a beautiful and really thoughtful translation to talk about and for making time to talk with me today. Welcome to the channel.
Thank you, Carla, and thank you so much for having me on. It is really a total pleasure to talk to you today.
Oh, for me too. So, Eleanor, as is traditional for the channel, can you start off by saying a little bit about what brought you to work in this field? So how did you become interested in contemporary and modern Chinese poetry?
I guess my interest may have started in a different place from other translators. It did not actually start with Chinese. It started with American poetry. So I'm a poet myself. I write poetry. And I went to the Boston University writing program for a master's degree. And this was after I had lived for a year in Shanghai. But it had never occurred to me to translate Chinese poetry, although I had at that time read some of it. And I, in the course of the degree at BU, at that time, there was a wonderful translation seminar run by Rosanna Warren. It's still offered now, but she was really kind of the, she started the that particular class, and it was an amazing program. And at the end of it, we had to do a sort of portfolio of translations. And because I had studied French in college, I thought I would do some French. And I told that to Rosanna, and she said, "What are you talking about? You just came back from Shanghai. You speak Chinese. I've never had any student do a Chinese portfolio. You're doing a Chinese poet." So, of course, I was terrified. And it didn't occur to me, actually, to go to contemporary Chinese poetry. I started where a lot of people probably start, with Tang Dynasty poetry, and in particular, Wang Wei, whom I really enjoy. And I was lucky enough to work with Hajin, who's still at BU, to do a portfolio. And he was amazing. He met with me every week and helped me through this. And I discovered that translating was totally impossible. I mean, you just cannot conceivably get into the English, you know, everything that's there, or even a very small percentage of what's there in the Chinese. And I guess I found that kind of inherently interesting and a challenge. And so I continued to translate Tang Shi, you know, Wang Wei, Li Bai, Du Mu, I never did Dufu because I wasn't so interested in the political side of it. But, and I did it primarily really at that point as a way to practice Chinese, to read more, to kind of keep the skills that, I had learned in college and then, living in Shanghai. And then I was extremely lucky in 2007 to meet a wonderful poet, Wang Ao, who's here in the States. And at that time, he was a graduate student at Yale. And we started to work together in various ways. But in particular, he suggested that we start translating contemporary poetry. And so my first publications of contemporary poets are collaborations with him. And I learned so much from working with a Chinese poet and also a wonderful, writer about poetry, thinker about poetry. And I learned a tremendous amount from Wang Ao. And then, I started to kind of branch out on my own and started to do my own translations. And this book really was the beginning of kind of going out on my own as a translator.
Very, very cool. So this is a book that is devoted to translating the poetry of Wang Xiaomi. So for listeners who may not be familiar with her or her poetry, can you tell us a little bit about her? What do you think we need to understand about Wang Xiaomi as a person to kind of prepare us to get into this poetry? And what brought you to her work in the first place?
Well, Wang Xiaomi, among sort of contemporary poets, I see her as something of an anomaly. She doesn't participate in a lot of the sort of poetry events. She doesn't go to the poetry conferences for the most part, which, tend to be kind of these massive parties where a bunch of poets get together and drink baijiu and, and make fun of each other. She's, in a lot of ways, a very, shy person. She, doesn't, travel a whole lot out of China or at this point really in China. So in that way, she's sort of unusual, in the general scene. And I think it's very important for readers coming to Wang Xiaomi's work for the first time to understand her as very much a northerner. So, she's a real Dongbairen. And you see that kind of all over her work. She was born in Changchun in Jilin in 1955. And when she reads her work, she has this fantastic Dongbei accent, which is just really, it adds a whole other level to her poetry. And I often wish in my readings, usually I'll read a little bit in Chinese, and I wish I could imitate her accent because it's just really so rich and so fantastic. But in the early 80s, after graduating from college, she was part of sort of the first wave of students to go back to college. She moved from the north to Shenzhen. And I think that dislocation has been kind of a very rich area that she's explored in her own psyche, but also sort of, geographically, in terms of the products of these different places, the foods of these different places, the climate. And that you can read a lot of her work sort of from that perspective. Mm-hmm.
So one of the wonderful things about this book is, of course, the poetry is, it's beautiful, it's evocative, and a lot of the poems really kind of burst forth in showing us and opening up for us exactly the kinds of things that you've just been talking about. And so for listeners, why don't we just dive in?
That'd be great. Let's do it.
Let's swim our way through the poems and sort of stop and come up and talk about along the way some of what you take to be some of the most interesting things to come out of these poems while we're reading and translating. Shall we do it?
Sounds great.
Okay, great. So one of the things that we were talking about a little bit earlier before the interview was the interest and importance of a particular poem that you mentioned, Starting Anew as a Poet. Shall we start there? And would you mind reading that for us? And then we can kind of open that up a little bit.
Great. I would love to. So this is Starting Anew as a Poet. 重新做一个诗人. At the shortest end of the century, the earth bounces. Humans busy themselves like monkeys between trees. But my two hands lie idle in China's air. The tabletop and the wind are both pure white paper. I let my significance happen only at home. Rinsing white rice, the rice starch drips like milk onto my page. To be reborn, the gourds extend their fingers and cry out in fear. Outside, the sunlight cuts with a knife heaven's cold, heavy snow. Each day, from morning to night, the door is shut tight. I hang the sun at the angle I need it. Some people say, in this town lives a person who doesn't work. Fastened to the walls between two small pieces of glass, the world self-combusts. The taciturn butterflies flutter everywhere. The universe unknowingly leaks its secrets. I foretell the tiniest signs of trouble, without eyes, without hands, without ears. Each day I write only a few words, like a knife cutting into the gush of a tangerine's finely woven juice. Let layer upon layer of blue light enter into a world that's never been described. No one sees my light, finely woven, strand by strand, like silk. In this city, I silently serve as a poet.
Ah, amazing. Okay, so Eleanor, for you, when you read this, what emerges for you from this poem as some of the images or issues or resonances that for you speak to and convey Wang Xiaoni's poetry more generally?
Well, first I should just say that every time I read this poem, and I love to end my readings with this, because I think it's a great kind of, you know, summing up. It still gives me goosebumps. I just think it's really an incredibly powerful work. And I just feel so lucky to have, you know, been able to translate this. There's, you know, and it's incredibly rich. There's so much going on in here. I guess in terms of sort of how to understand Wang Xiaoni and how she sees herself, I think, I let my significance happen only at home. Mm-hmm. Is incredibly important. For one, you know, it's a very personal statement. Wang Xiaoni has been married for, you know, many years. She has a son who's now grown. He's in his 30s. And her husband happens to be, Xu Jingya, who's a very famous, literary critic. So they're kind of this literary, this dynamic duo. you know, Wang Xiaoni, I think, still thinks of herself as very much a, housewife in a certain sense. Mm-hmm. She takes great pleasure in cooking. She takes great pleasure in gardening. And Shenzhen is a great place to garden. She's also extremely private, like I said before. So I think those lines really, kind of point to, how she sees her role. She wants her work in the sort of outside world. She wants her work to speak for her. And her sort of exterior appearance, her sort of public appearance, is going to be very limited. I think also, though, and this is incredible, this is really typical of Wang Xiaoni and very important to understand about her, is that that line, I think, also is a comment about the larger situation of women in Chinese culture and society, certainly of the 80s and 90s. I don't have the exact date of when this poem was read, but was written, but it was composed, I think, sometime in the late 80s or early 90s, at a time when women really were expected to, you know, have a place in the home. And that was really just starting to change, you know, despite the holding up the other half of the sky or whatever. I mean, there was still and continues to be a real difference between the way men and women are treated in a professional sense. So I think that very much serves, those lines serve as a kind of personal reflection and a much larger commentary. And Wang Xiaoni does that incredibly skillfully throughout her work. I think similarly, you know, I hang the sun at the angle I need it. Some people say in this town lives a person who doesn't work. So Wang Xiaoni has an incredible work ethic. You know, she's put out a ton of books, from, you know, poetry to prose. She's written novels. She's written about her experiences teaching. She's, you know, constantly writing in addition to sort of keeping a household going. But the way that poets are regarded now, in the culture in China is, you know, how shall I say this politely? I mean, they're not really taken as doing work that matters. So, and people will talk about you, you know, why doesn't she go to work every day? You know, so I think those are all things that, are important to understanding not just this poem, but Wang Xiaoni herself as a poet.
Great. Now, the last line of the poem, in this city, I silently serve as a poet, that silence.
Mm-hmm.
This is also something that comes up in many of the other poems. And you talk in the introduction and, you know, it's very clear in some of the other poems about the importance of a sense of isolation, right? Passivity, silence in her work. Are there any other poems, or is there one that comes to mind immediately for you, that you might also read for us? As long as, you know, as long as you're offering to do this, it's beautiful. Let's just keep doing it. That might sort of let us or help us experience and think about the importance of silence and aloneness and isolation here.
Definitely. Well, I mean, she has a poem that sort of directly addresses that. It's called A Rag's Betrayal. Mm-hmm. And I should just say that I love to read the poetry aloud. In part because it's wonderful work and I get a lot of pleasure out of it. But I also think, you know, in talking about poetry, the most important thing is actually to hear the poems. So thank you so much for, you know, giving me an opportunity to read.
I love this. This
great.
Is, I would keep you for 5 more hours, honestly. Awesome. If you kept, I won't.
If my voice doesn't give out, we'll just. All right. So this is A Rag's Betrayal. 你夸不得背叛. I hadn't expected, after I wiped the glass clean, the entire world would immediately infiltrate in. The last shelter disappeared with the water. Even the leaves thickened their eyebrows to spy in. I hadn't thought such a mistake could be made with only 2 hours of work and a rag. Everything is a master of betrayal. This most ancient craftsmanship was easily accomplished by a soft, dirty rag. Now I'm stranded in the midst of its exposure. Other people's greatest freedom is the freedom to see. In this complex and beautiful springtime, cubism walks across the canvas. Everyone has a superhuman power to traverse barriers. My life is penetrated in layers. Hiding in the depths of the house, but exposed to people beyond these four walls, I'm just a poor, bare body. A thatched peachwood chair, I hide in its wooden strips, my thoughts restless. The earth should be reduced to dust. I'd rather return to the pit of that peach tree seed. Only humans want secrecy. Now I'd like to pass myself off as anything but human. Mm-hmm. So there clearly you can see all of those issues about privacy, exposure, and like, you know, writing poetry and publishing poetry, it's through her own act of cleaning the windows that all of a sudden people can see her. And I think Wang Xiaoni is very, very sensitive to those issues of, you know, being a public figure in a time and place where being a public figure is itself dangerous.
Mm-hmm. And there's imagery here that also comes up in some of the other poetry once you're kind of looking for it, right? Glass and windows and sort of, there's a lot of, it's not so much here, but if you imagine what's infiltrating in through a window, there's a lot of sun in a lot of these poems, right? And so there's, and it's just totally beautiful, beautiful object. Thank you so much for reading this to us.
Thank you.
I mean, one of the other things that comes up kind of incidentally in this poem also might lead us to another really important theme that we can go to from here. And this is the line where she says, everyone has a superhuman power. Well, the line where you say, right? Everyone has a superhuman power to traverse barriers. That idea of traversing barriers, right, and movement and travel and traversing, this also, I think, gives us an opportunity to think about another issue that you bring up early in the book that's very important to us as we understand her poetry, and that's sort of travel and dislocation. You've already talked a little bit about the fact that she's a northerner writing in the South, this sense of dislocation of outsider status, but also of travel comes up over and over again. There are planes here. There are buses here. There are trains here. There's a lot of traveling and movement happening. Is there another poem that you might read for us that might help us get further into that, right? Traveling and the media thereof, and whatever you think is most interesting about this constellation of issues.
Sure, absolutely. She has a sort of series of poems that are, you know, thoughts upon crossing a particular province, you know, Guo Yunanji, Guo Guanxiji, and so on, Guo Guizhouji. So she's, these are kind of, I think of them as these, as travel poems or as train window poems. You just mentioned windows as a kind of element that comes, you know, that returns. And certainly there are a lot of train windows. You know, I picture her as the poet sitting on this train and observing what she sees going past. I know she writes a lot on the train and on airplanes. I mean, it's wonderful that one of the complexities of Wang Xiaoni is that, you know, for a woman who loves to hide herself at home, she has an awful lot of travel poems. So let me just read one of these train poems. Let's do Thoughts Upon Crossing Yunnan, Guo Yunanji. The tigers retreat. The hawks retreat too. The killers and the killed flee to other provinces. The sky clears its lower left corner before Yunnan covers its head to sleep. This red lord of the manor sleeps comfortably. From the side, the curves are suddenly high and round. A red body shows beneath the green robe, deeper than red, deeper than cliffs, deeper than the demands of seeds. There is only red, not fire. There is only a body, not a lord. The grass climbs up to the top of its head and shakes with fear. The canyon's teeth sparkle with lazy light. The soil grows fat with clusters of corn. Red Yunnan doesn't work and doesn't get flustered. Now, empty mountain echoes run everywhere. I hold tight to my heart and pass through the red lead tongue.
So this is, hear here and we see here colors, which are often, right, we're come up in a lot of these poems. We read about soil and things that grow in the soil, right, corn. And there are a number of poems that talk about crops and animals and farming and soil. We see mountains here, and these come up again and again. For you, are there things about this particular poem that strike you as particularly kind of interesting or resonant?
I think for me, what attracts me so much to this particular poem are these kind of wonderful leaps that she makes. So, you know, the grass climbs up to the top of its head, meaning the mountain's head, and shakes with fear. You know, that's really creative and yet a very kind of solid image. You know, you can picture the grass sort of swaying in the wind, you know, as trembling. The canyon's teeth sparkle with lazy light. These you know, rocks that have this kind of crystalline gleam to them. So I really admire just sort of the technique that Wang Xiaoni has here of spinning these really wonderful, rich metaphors, and yet being totally anchored in the reality of what you actually see when you take a train across Yunnan. Again, I think, you know, she's a wonderfully complex poet, and there's another kind of seeming contradiction that she can take these flights of fancy and yet still be grounded, as you say, literally grounded in soil and in crops. She's, you know, she's a gardener herself, and she's very interested in plants and in flora, and in fauna, in the sense of, you know, animals of labor. I mean, farming animals and so on. What also strikes me about this poem, is that it is very impersonal throughout the beginning. There's nothing about her. There's nothing about the observer. The poet doesn't sort of insert herself until the last line. And then it's a real kind of whack on the head. You know, she really kind of turns the poem at that point into a very personal meditation. That takes a lot of skill to do well. And Wang Xiaoni certainly is an incredibly skilled poet.
So let's kind of move from here, and we'll come back to the poems for sure.
Great.
Because, you know, as much as we can, I'd love to do that. But let's step out a little bit to talk a little bit about your own practices and your own craft as a translator, and the ways that influenced how we are able to appreciate and how, you know, the medium in which we're able to appreciate her poetry. So we've already heard a few different poems that you've generously and kindly enough read to us. How did you go about choosing and picking, you know, the poems that you were going to include and translate in this volume? Like, what was that editing and curating process like for you?
Well, I was either lucky or very lazy or both. This is actually a collection in Chinese.
Okay.
So the book, 有什么在我心里过, constitutes almost all of the book. So I just translated what was in the book, with the exception of the last two longer poems, which are more recent and which Wang Xiaoni herself sent to me. So in that sense, you know, it was all laid out for me, which was wonderful. And I believe I think we cut maybe two poems from that collection that were not working for some reason in the English. But the rest we kept. I mean, she's despite being a, you know, a very complex poet in many ways, I think her poetry just really works in English. So we were able to sort of keep the bulk of that collection.
And how closely did you work with her over the course of this translation? And if, you know, it sounds like you were in touch with her, right? And she was sending you poems. What was the nature of that collaborative process like?
So when I started the book, I had never met Wang Xiaoni. And she, you know, clearly had no idea who I was. But we had a mutual friend in common, the wonderful, American poet, Afa Michael Weaver, who also has done, spent time in Taiwan and has done some, collaborations on some sort of co-translations of, contemporary poetry. And he knew of Wan Xiaoni and was actually, I had translated some of her work, but before that, but, he was the one who suggested that I sort of approach her and ask her if I could do, a collection, translate a collection of hers. And she was extremely generous and I must say trusting, when she handed this, manuscript over to me. After that point, I actually didn't have any contact with her until the book was done. I think translators have to be very wary of working with poets, for many reasons. Wan Xiaoni is, her English isn't great. She speaks a little bit, she reads a little bit, but, you know, she's very much steeped in Chinese. So that was one aspect, but, essentially I thought of it, I thought of my task as a translator, and continue to think of it as being to bring these poems into English so that they function in English as, works of art. Mm-hmm. So at a certain point, you know, the translations really have to be mine. And it can be very dangerous to have the intervention of, poets, although sometimes, you know, very useful on a kind of, literal, what does this word mean sense. I think ultimately the translator, it, you know, is the quote unquote original author of the English, works. Since then, it's been wonderful. I've visited her in Shenzhen. We saw each other in Canada at the Griffin Prize ceremony. I hope to see her again in the spring. So we've had actually a lot more, contact kind of after the book has come out and seen a little bit of, success than during the actual process of translating.
Were there any poems in particular or any aspects of her poetic language specifically that were particularly challenging to work on as a translator?
I mean, as a translator, and of course, I mean, Carla, you know this yourself very well. You know, you're sort of constantly confronted with issues. I would say that, you know, there was something in every single one of these poems that, that, you know, I put a star next to, which in, you know, in my drafts, that's the kind of, okay, here's a problem, or I don't know what to do here, or this is a temporary solution. And a lot of those original starred places, you know, got revised, until they were unrecognizable. And other times, you know, they ended up being my original stab at something. Like I said earlier, I mean, Wan Xiaoni's poetry, I would say more than some, contemporary writers, like, you know, Zhang Di or, Bai Hua or, writers who are very interested in reference, for example, or, you know, in these, in kind of John Ashbery type sort of juxtapositions or a lot of pop references. Wan Xiaoni is much more direct. She doesn't play a lot of word games. Her rhetoric is sort of much more straightforward. So from that aspect, from sort of a, you know, kind of on the level of, can I figure out what's going on here? She was pretty easy to bring over into English. What's difficult was to get the resonances, mm-hmm. And the tone. I think of one particular example. I gave a little lecture at, Fudan University, just a couple months ago. And I brought in the, poem Seeing Potatoes. Which, you know, is a poem that, I feel fairly satisfied with in English. And the students and other, you know, faculty members who had come to hear the lecture were very concerned about the, at the end of the first stanza, there's a line, 头脑发热的东北人, which I translated a feverish Northeasterner. And they were very concerned about the translation of the, 头脑发热, because it's 东北话. It's a very colloquial sort of like, oh, you know, she's hot-headed. She's, but not in the sense of easily angered, but rather in this kind of cute, sort of flustery, you know, running around kind of excited sort of way. So it's the sort of exact implications, of what every term means, that's really difficult to get. And I think particularly in poetry, I mean, I also translate a lot of fiction, and it's not the same. There isn't as much weight resting on every single word. And, you know, poets are notorious for using language in flexible ways and for, you know, I mean, getting double meanings out of things. And so those sorts of challenges, which you're really confronted with any, you know, poetry translation, I certainly confronted throughout this book. And, you know, looking at it now, I mean, you know, authors are notorious for this, but I mean, there are tons of things that I would change at this point, despite being satisfied with the book. You know, overall, there are lots of little details that I would go back and kind of polish again, or, you know, try to come up with a different solution.
Of course. I mean, it's always in process, right? I mean, I've got
absolutely
these files devoted to Manchu poetry I'm trying to translate right now that are like color-coded, and you have to make the decision, like, here's a sound. Do I want to try to like reproduce that sound in English, or like what
absolutely
do I do? So, and that actually struck me, speaking of sounds, that you were talking about the power of Wang Xiaoni's own voice when she's reading them, right? So, and you're a poet yourself. I mean, the kind of attentiveness to sound and the sonic here, was that, how did that play out, if at all, in your decisions to render and to create your own translations here in English? Like, how much did the sound and your sonic experience of these works shape your work as a translator here?
Oh, it was hugely important. It was hugely important. I mean, this, just to speak really briefly to that last point, I mean, you also are constantly learning about the poet as you translate, right? So, you know, by poem 50, I know much more than I did when I translated poem one. With a depth that you don't get just by reading them. I mean, translation is the most intimate and the most intense form of reading you possibly could have. Yeah. So, I mean, and in terms of the sounds also, the more I worked with Wang Xiaoni's poetry in general, the more I had a sense of her cadence, of the kinds. I said earlier that she doesn't do wordplay, but she's incredibly sensitive to sound. And sound also, to me as a translator and also as a poet, is very important. So, you know, Wang Xiaoni doesn't use sort of end rhyme, but she uses a lot of, you know, play with sounds, a lot of sort of mirroring of sounds. And I tried to, capture as much as I could of that in the English, although I didn't feel sort of beholden to the original text in that sense. So if, you know, on line 7, there's some effect, I didn't feel like I necessarily had to have some similar effect in English in the same spot. Okay. I mean, you can try to do that, but often you end up with either disasters or you end up kind of twisting the original meaning or the, you know, original line, in order to kind of get a rhyme or get some sort of effect. So I would rather sacrifice that kind of parallelism between the original and the translation, for a translation that really functions like a poem in the English. And in my process, the last step, I set aside the original Chinese and look at my translation simply as an English language poem. Mm-hmm. And at that point, you know, I decide, okay, well, you know, maybe there was a ton of, you know, sound effect going on here in the original, but in the translation, it's just not working. I need to calm things down. One thing that I do really try to protect is the structure of the poem. So if something, you know, if something happens grammatically on line 3 in the original, I really try to keep that happening on line 3 in the translation. I don't add lines. Sometimes it's absolutely impossible because, you know, as we all know, the grammatical structure of Chinese is so different from the grammatical structure of English. But I mean, in a poem, sequence really, really, really matters. So I'll try as hard as I can to protect that, the overriding structure. But smaller details, I think, have to be sort of in the end determined by what's going to work in English and what's not working in English.
That's right. Well, another, you mentioned the potatoes poem, right? Seeing potatoes. And
yes.
One of the things that we haven't talked a whole lot about, we've just sort of talked about it a little bit, is the importance of kind of material objects, right? Mm-hmm. These poems are full of, like we're talking about crop plants and animals, mm-hmm. like pigs and peanuts and corn and potatoes. Would you do you want to read Seeing Potatoes for us to sort of
sure.
give us a way into or another opportunity to experience that in your translation?
Absolutely, absolutely. I should say, you know, potatoes in northern China function like they did, say in northern Europe. You know, they're a staple, and there's something, you know, you have to eat. You pull it out of your root cellar in the winter when you're, you know, when there's nothing else to eat except for cabbage and, you know, turnip. And which is not true in the South, right? So she's functioning very much, you know, to go back to that sense of displacement, her reaction to these potatoes, in the South are, you know, is very different from the way that a Southerner would react to the potatoes. Anyway, I'll read it and I'm sure it'll come through.
Okay. Thank you.
Seeing potatoes. And here's one place actually that I wish I could imitate, Wang Xiaoni's, northern accent, because potatoes, 土豆, you know, I won't even attempt it because people will laugh, but, her 土豆 is, you know, 土豆. She has that R, that wonderful northern R in her reading. Okay. Seeing potatoes, 看到土豆. Seeing a basket of potatoes, I was as thrilled as if I'd encountered a ghost. So thrilled, I became a feverish Northeasterner. I wanted to stare into their eyes to find out all they'd been through. Unexpectedly, unreasonable emotion attacked me head on. A timid, superficial light fell layer upon layer. All the precise sutures in my body broke. I wanted to stop right away, stop myself completely, and bum a cigarette off an addict, his last cigarette. Nothing can attack you like a basket of potatoes. Returning to the past is like walking all the way to Jupiter. But today, I saw a basket of potatoes. All at once, I was stepping on Jupiter's burning rings.
Wow. So, can you open up for us some of the moments, or maybe a moment or two in here for you that are most powerful in terms of your experience with this poem?
Well, I guess I love that she starts with kind of, you know, one of the earthiest things you can imagine, right? Potatoes, these, you know, these tubers, right?
They were on Jupiter.
Oh, they were on Jupiter. It's this beautiful kind of leap, you know, how did we, and the reader, I think at the end of that has to ask him or herself, how did we end up here? How did this happen? And how did that happen through potatoes? Which is a really kind of fantastic arc for a poem to take, starting in this, very ordinary place and ending up somewhere totally unexpected. Just to talk just a little bit about the translation here, there was I think translators, we love to bemoan all of the things that are lost, all of the difficulties of translation, and, you know, and all of that is totally true. But here, you know, and elsewhere, very occasionally you really have something that falls in your lap. And in this case, it's the line, I wanted to stare into their eyes.
Yeah.
So what she uses is wuguan, which is face, literally, right? Their visage, their face. But in English, you know, potatoes have eyes. And we stare into somebody's eyes, you know, to connect with them. Or so there was a case where this cute little, double meaning, this little pun, this little turn just fell into my lap, by virtue of the language that I'm working in. So for every moment that, where you lose some kind of double meaning in the Chinese, very occasionally you get something that your target language brings to you. And that was one such occasion.
It's completely awesome. And also it's really nice the way, with the eyes and the head on and the body, this poem also really brings out, and sort of puts into relief the importance of bodies and body parts in these poems as well. I mean, right?
It's fantastic. I love that you, notice that and point it out because, I did a thing in Leeds with Heather Inwood, who's another wonderful translator and researcher of, contemporary poetry, contemporary Chinese poetry. And she was talking about the, lower body poets. And I made the joke that, you know, Wan Xiaoni doesn't deal with anything like below the neck, which in a certain sense is true. I mean, there's no sex. There's nothing sort of quote unquote dirty or, you know, even sexually suggestive or, you know, I mean, she's in that sense, like an incredibly clean, poet. And yet her poems are really kind of rooted in, the body and bodily sensation. There's a lot of, color and smell and tactile sense, sounds, and also literal body parts, you know?
And knives, right? I mean, like yes, when you start looking, like how many times do you see a knife in these poems? And talk about attentiveness to fleshing and bodies, right?
Absolutely. And those knives often, come in these really unexpected places. Do you mind if I read another poem?
Please, that would be awesome.
Okay. Well, Wan Xiaoni loves the moon. She has, and in fact, she just informed me, that she has put together an entire book of moon poems, which I'm hoping she will, you know, let me, I think she's sort of offered it to me. I'm hoping, cause they're wonderful. It's kind of a wonderful trope for her. So here's one of her, there are three, moonlight poems, in this book. There are many poems that, use the moon or moonlight, but three titled moonlight poems. So here's the first one, moonlight number one, 月光之一. The moon unexpectedly casts its light. A warm ocean island's metal shell glints, and the earth shows its hidden treasures. This armor that practices falling onto shoulders gives off only a cold light and no sound. In silver fragments that float farther and farther, tonight I should at least find something to do. Violence takes its chance to hide even deeper. An outstretched hand reaches the light, so soft that no matter the angle, it never looks like a dagger. I mean, talk about taking leaps, right?
I know.
It's so unexpected and so forceful in a very, it's the force of a dagger, right? It's the force of a tip, a very sharp tip, rather than a kind of blunt force. And a real surprise. I think, there's a lot of sort of, underlying violence or threat of violence in Wan Xiaomi's work that she almost always comes at sideways. So, you know, lines like that, you know, it never looks like a dagger, kind of, you know, taking you by surprise very delicately. She has a wonderful skill for that. And knives and daggers and things like that kind of play a subtle but very noticeable role in her work. And I think it kind of represents that sort of looming threat.
Absolutely. And this also kind of, and you know, hearing you read and hearing you talk about your own crafting of these as really beautiful works of art in English, and also kind of hearkening back to our something that you said about translation being the most intimate form of reading, right, and engagement. It also makes me wonder, since you are also, I mean, this is also your poetry, right? Mm-hmm. You are also a practicing poet who's writing in English, right?
Yes.
From so your own, I don't know how to, you know, once you start kind of thinking about these lines, you know, but this is also your poetry, and it's a translation and stuff like it's, I kind of get caught up in the language, but you know where I'm going with this. So I actually love to hear you talk a little bit about the ways that your art as a translator, and maybe particularly in the case of this collection of poems, has shaped, if at all, your work as a poet in other senses?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the reasons that this collection was such a joy to work on, in addition to, you know, it just being really fantastic poetry, is that I really did learn a tremendous amount from Wan Xiaomi. She's very skillful. She's very subtle. She's in complete control of everything that happens in her poem, which is much more difficult than you would imagine. And so in translating these, I certainly found a lot to admire and a lot to learn from. I guess in my own work, and I write only in English. I don't dare write in Chinese except for fun. I do myself see the influence of Chinese poetry. For one thing, Chinese poets play with the fact that the Chinese language is very flexible in terms of sort of where the grammatical elements are placed. It's much more flexible in that sense than English is. And there's a lot more ambiguity, for example, things that are just really horrifying to translators, like, okay, what is the subject of this sentence? You know, you can drop a pronoun, or, you know, numbers of things. Are we talking about a singular thing or a plural thing? Mm-hmm. That often is not clear. And poets will play with those kinds of ambiguities. And in my own work, that's something that I've tried to think about and become more sensitive to and to utilize. I think of myself as a rather traditional poet, so I wouldn't, Jonathan Stalling, who's also a translator and a poet himself, has done these incredible kind of English-Chinese amalgamations. He uses literal Chinese in his work, even when he's writing in English. And if you want an explanation for that, you should talk to him. And it's wonderful and it's exciting. And it's something that I really couldn't do. That's sort of beyond the bounds of my own, kind of creative interests, but certainly everything I read, in Chinese or in English is kind of, nourishment. And certainly I've found a tremendous amount of inspiration in the Chinese poets that I've read. There's a lot of wonderful, wonderful stuff going on right now.
So let's talk a little bit about the particular press and the series that this is part of, right? This book came out with Zephyr Press, right?
Yes.
And it's part of what sounds like and what seems like a very special and very exciting series. So do you want to talk a little bit about that?
So Zephyr is a fantastic literary press, devoted to primarily to translation, although they have some sort of English language poetry as well. But, you know, primarily translation. And originally, their list was a lot of Russian literature and translation and some South American stuff. And they sort of started this joint venture with Beidal, who is now in Hong Kong, to start this Jintian series under the auspices of his, I think it's called the Jintian Foundation. And this is a series of books of single author collections. So, here in the United States, it's very difficult to publish a single author collection. Lucas Klein, whom you had on the show earlier, his Notes on the Mosquito, which is a fantastic translation and wonderful poetry by Sichuan, came out from New Directions, and that's a single author collection. And there are a few, I can probably count them on one hand, of other, major collections by contemporary Chinese poets. So the Jintian Foundation provides the structure for this collection, and they've done some fantastic poets, including Wang Xiaomi, Xia Yu, Yu Hua. Yu Xiang. Xia Yu was also done by Zephyr, but it's not in the series. So I feel incredibly grateful to Zephyr Press and the editors I worked with and continue to work with, Jim Cates, who's a fantastic translator and poet himself, Laura Zeitlin, and in particular Chris Madison, who was the sort of the on the ground, let's make this book editor. He was the one I went back and forth with drafts and ideas for the cover and so on. And it was just a fantastic experience working with him. And they produced a really beautiful book. You know, it's good paper. It's a really nice cover. It feels weighty. It feels like it's a real thing. And I think too often, poetry in general, but especially poetry in translation, is kind of published in these really, they look like pamphlets. It's sloppily put together. It's sloppily edited. And it's a question of, the funding that is just not available, to these small presses to put out really quality things. So I feel really grateful to Zephyr Press for having put this beautiful, beautiful book together.
It is gorgeous. And I'll just kind of emphasize that as well from my perspective to listeners. It's beautiful. It feels good. Mm-hmm. It's a gorgeous object. Well done, Zephyr Press. In that respect, it's a really beautiful object.
Thank you.
So as we come to the conclusion of our talk, I can't believe it's already been almost an hour.
It flew by.
As we sort of kind of come to an end, if not the end, let's look ahead a little bit. Are there any other, like if you kind of had your ideal world and a translation, an English translation of another work by any contemporary Chinese poet that you particularly like could appear magically right now, who do you think would be a particularly exciting poet to have a translation of into English right now?
Wow, that is a that's a really tough question.
I know, and I'm hitting you with this right at the end. Sorry, I know. Or is there like one, it doesn't have to be like the definitive one, but does one immediately come to mind with no pressure to necessarily be comprehensive, but someone that doesn't already exist in translation in a kind of substantive way in English who might be good from your perspective to have in an English translation?
Well, I know you're going to ask me about, let this serve as a lead-in, a very self-serving lead-in.
That's great. I love self-serving lead-ins.
So actually what my next project, so not the immediate project, but the one after that, is to translate, the poetry of Zhang Di, who is a really, really important poet. Virtually none of his work exists in English. He's won tons of awards. He's a professor at Beda. He's kind of had all these laurels, heaped on him. He's published a ton of stuff and there's essentially nothing in English. So he actually will also have a book out from Zephyr. Right now it's slated for 2017, and I'm about to spend a month in the wilds of Vermont with Zandi working on this book. So if either one of us makes it out alive, there should be a translation in another year or so, a little over a year.
Oh, that's really exciting. So if that's the next project, what's the next project for you?
So the next project, I'm really lucky to be working with Chris Madison again. He is a man who wears many editorial hats. And he's doing a series of translations of Hong Kong poets. Jennifer Feely, another fantastic translator, just came out with a translation of Xi Xi, who's a very important Hong Kong poet. And I am doing the next one. We will be looking at proofs, hopefully in the next 2 or 3 months, of a wonderful Hong Kong poet called Luo Feng. She also goes by the English name Natalia Chan. She's terrific. She's extremely different from Wang Xianyi. She has a lot of pop references. She's writing in Cantonese. I mean, the characters obviously are, they're Chinese characters, but she's using the language very differently from the way a mainland writer does. She's got some fantastic work. So hopefully that book will be coming out in spring of 2016 from Hong Kong Baptist University Press.
Wow. So I'm putting in a request right now, officially, publicly on the air, to interview you about that if you want to.
It's a total pleasure.
So Eleanor, there's a lot kind of obviously that we didn't have a chance to talk about, right? There's so much more we could talk about, but we have to, I don't want to keep you for more than an hour. Is there anything in particular, though, that we didn't have a chance to talk about in this hour that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Carla, you are a fantastic interviewer. And I've just had so much fun talking on this show. I feel like you covered the bases. I hope it was, a good introduction to Wang Xianyi and this, Zephyr Press series. And I hope people go look for the books, because if you want an introduction to, really almost any aspect of the public culture, you will find it in these poets. It's an incredible view on what's actually happening on the ground, in day-to-day life in China, and what people are thinking about and what they're afraid of and, what they're enjoying. So it's a wonderful window.
Wonderful. And so I'm going to kind of break with tradition now and ask you a final question. Before we wrap up, Eleanor, could you leave us actually with another reading? Just sort of so that we can end on a poem, and any poem that you want, that you'd like to read for us.
Yes. So I said earlier that, I always read the Starting Anew as a Poet poem. Every reading, I end with that. There's one other poem that I always read because it's just a personal favorite of mine. This might be my favorite of all of the Wang Xianyi that I've read, and I think I've read almost all of her work. This is just my personal taste. So the poem is called Moonlight is Very White. 月光白得很. Late at night, the moon exposes every bone. I breathe in a pale breath. The world's irritations become falling fireflies. The city is a lifeless skeleton. No life can match this pure night light. Open the curtains, and before my eyes, the universe mixes with silver. The moonlight helps me forget I'm alone. Life's last act is silently rehearsed on a swath of white. Moonlight arrives on the floorboards. My 2 feet are already pale.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Thank you, Carla. It was such a pleasure.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.